grasses are giving a new life to previously mined land in Appalachia.
We've never fertilized them. We've never done anything to them other than let them grow.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, coal fields are fertile ground for fast-growing grasses that can be used for biofuel. And a fungus is changing the behavior of infected cicadas.
Males, for example, in addition to attempting to mate with females, will also pretend to be females to engage with males to further spread the fungus.
Plus, renewable energy is making up a larger share of energy production as aging nuclear plants are decommissioned.
The issue, though, is that with some of the abrupt closure of these existing plants, there's a threat that they're going to be replaced with natural gas.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Nuclear plants provide 20% of U.S. power generation, and it's a low-carbon source of energy. But older nuclear plants around the country are slated to close in the coming years. In an effort to keep them running, some in the Trump administration are pushing to reduce safety regulations for nuclear reactors. In the age of climate change, the director of energy research and analysis at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Steve Klemmer, says he doesn't want this carbon-free power source to die, but he's fearful that rolling back safety measures isn't the right approach to save it. He wrote a report last year called The Nuclear Dilemma, and he joined the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for our Trump on Earth podcast to talk about it.
After Three Mile Island, the nuclear accident in Chernobyl in 1986, we might have expected a group like yours, or maybe more so an environmental group rather than a scientific group, to oppose nuclear power outright. But it sounds like the Union of Concerned Scientists supports the use of nuclear power. Can you kind of talk about why you think it's important to maintain this fleet?
Yeah, unfortunately, our report has been mischaracterized pretty widely. UCS has been a nuclear safety watchdog for more than 40 years and a leading advocate of renewable energy. But at the same time, we've long recognized that nuclear power is a source of low-carbon electricity, an important source for the U.S., and that the premature retirement of these plants could set back national efforts to reduce emissions. And the scope and impact of climate change really demands that we consider all low-carbon options, including nuclear power. When we released our report, it came out about a week after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its report last November that found to limit global average temperature increases to 1.5 degrees Celsius that we essentially needed to get to net zero emissions economy-wide by mid-century. In order to do that, we need every low-carbon source of energy we can get.
You know, as mentioned, nuclear power, according to your report, currently provides about 20% of power generation in the country. Like, can you put that in perspective? Is there's nothing else that's going to come in, like wind, solar, other non-carbon emitting sources of energy? Like, is there anything else sort of that could step in?
Yeah, those sources of energy can step in. In fact, they've been growing rapidly in the United States. Both wind and solar have increased dramatically. When combined with hydro and other renewable energy sources, we're close to actually producing 20% of the country's electricity from renewable energy sources. And those sources are going to continue to grow and actually surpass nuclear. The issue, though, is that with some of the abrupt closure of these existing plants, there's a threat that they're going to be replaced with natural gas, because we've also seen natural gas generation grow dramatically in the U.S., mainly due to the fracking boom over the past decade. We've seen the price of natural gas and the wholesale price of electricity come down by about 50 to 70%. And that's really reduced the revenues that are going to existing nuclear plants. Because of that, you know, our report found that about a third of the existing nuclear fleet in the United States was either uneconomic or slated to close over the next decade. We also did some modeling that found that if those plants did shut down, they would be primarily replaced with natural gas, which could cause carbon emissions to rise at a time when we really need to be achieving deep cuts in emissions to limit the worst impacts of climate change.
The Trump administration's push to reduce regulations on industry is well known. What have we heard from the administration in terms of regulation of nuclear plants?
Yeah, unfortunately, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just came out with a report that you may have heard about that is proposing to reduce safety inspections and weaken safety standards. And we're very strongly opposed to some of these recommendations. It would include things like reducing inspections from once every 2 years to once every 3 years. It would also change the NRC's rating system that they have, that they do every quarter for every reactor in the country. And it would allow plant owners to essentially remove any safety violations that they have immediately from their record instead of keeping them on there for a year or more, which is current practice. And that could be a hindrance to the NRC to identify more widespread safety concerns and patterns that the industry is facing.
Now, we should mention that the NRC is not, you know, is independent of the administration, but President Trump does appoint some members to the NRC. Do we know, you know, why are they doing this? Is this to help the industry cut costs, or what's the reasoning behind some of their proposals?
You know, I think there's been a lot of pressure from the industry for years to roll back regulations in an effort to cut costs. We think that's not the right way to go at a time when the fleet's aging. And so, you know, for a long time, the NRC hasn't had the best record in terms of maintaining strong standards and actually improving them. We've been working on strengthening their standards for over 40 years and have been a watchdog for that. It's been a reoccurring problem, even though there are efforts by the Trump administration to, you know, do things that would benefit both the nuclear and coal industry. There's some separate proposals that they've put out there to try to bail out the coal industry, for example, by saying that they offer fuel security and resilience benefits, which we completely disagree with. And they've lumped both coal and nuclear into the same category. Fortunately, none of these policies or financial payments that they've been talking about have been approved. So we'll continue to fight that.
So some states have stepped forward. Ohio, Pennsylvania are two that are looking to bail out nuclear plants. Pennsylvania's bill would provide $500 million to the nuclear industry is still under consideration. Ohio's law has already been passed, $150 million annually to First Energy Solutions to keep two plants running in the state. What do you think of these kinds of bailouts?
Yeah, these approaches, you know, that a lot of people refer to as bailouts, and in some ways they are, in other ways not, but they are not sort of our preferred way to go about this. We think that more comprehensive policies like a price on carbon or a low carbon electricity standard that would create a more level playing field with fossil fuels, and it would also create competition between nuclear and renewable energy sources and other low carbon energy sources to reduce emissions at the lowest cost. But we recognize that some states aren't going to go for these policies, and we have seen kind of a diversity of approaches. We were involved to a certain degree in Illinois, New York, and New Jersey, all passed laws where they provided temporary support for certain distress plants, but then they also strengthened their renewable and energy efficiency standards, and they also adopted provisions that would limit cost to ratepayers. Unfortunately, the proposals in Ohio and Pennsylvania don't meet those conditions, and they are deeply flawed in our opinion. The law that was recently passed in Ohio is especially bad. In addition to just providing really a blatant handout to nuclear and to coal, they gutted their renewable energy and energy efficiency standards at the same time. You know, this goes against the trend that we've been seeing around the country, not just in the states that have been addressing nuclear, but, you know, states across the country have been increasing their renewables and efficiency standards, recognizing both the economic and environmental benefits of doing that, but also because the cost of these technologies have come way down.
Steve Klemmer is director of energy research and analysis at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more at trumponearth.org. or wherever you get your podcasts. Across Appalachian coal country, people are looking for productive ways to reuse land that's been damaged by surface mining. A 2018 study found that an area roughly the size of Delaware has been mined over the years. Liam Niemeyer reports that some researchers see promise in a fast-growing grass that can help restore damaged lands and might also help the economy.
Down bumpy back roads deep in central West Virginia, a bright green pasture opens up among the rolling hills of trees. West Virginia University professor Jeff Skousen wants to show off a type of grass that stands above the rest of the Appalachian scenery here, literally.
But you can see you can't hardly walk through this stuff. It's worse than a jungle.
He's dwarfed by this 10-feet tall, greenish-yellow grass called a giant miscanthus. Skousen and other researchers have been growing it on this former strip mine site for a decade. While other crops would struggle with the poor soil quality from past mining, giant miscanthus thrives.
We've never fertilized them. We've never done anything to them other than let them grow, which again demonstrates their ability to grow on sort of marginal mine land areas at this kind of rate every year.
And he believes that biomass could be a solution to revitalizing mined lands and coal mining communities.
Where we could grow a crop like this, sell it to an ethanol producer or some other heating agent, and suddenly we have another sort of economy develop for an agricultural community.
And there's a lot of old mine lands throughout the Ohio Valley. A 2018 Duke University study estimated some 1.5 million acres of central Appalachian land have been impacted by surface coal mining, roughly half of that since the 1980s. Other researchers say miscanthus can also give an ecological boost to these lands.
The health of soil, plants, animals, people, and the environment is one and indivisible.
That's Ohio State University Professor Rutan Lal. He's a soil scientist who led a study growing miscanthus on a former strip mine in southeastern Ohio. He says miscanthus has a thick root system that excels at taking carbon dioxide from the air to store in the soil. That could help fight climate change. And as more carbon and other nutrients are stored each year in this degraded soil, Lowell says the soil quality could improve too.
Hopefully that soil can be also used subsequently for food crop production, corn, soybean.
Efforts to turn miscanthus into an energy source also go back a decade. Yet some past efforts have failed because of a lack of demand. And some environmental activists are skeptical about miscanthus used for biomass energy. Cassa Heron is a member of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, a state progressive advocacy group. The organization put out a proposed clean energy plan in 2017 that excluded burning biomass in its proposal because they didn't consider it a carbon-neutral resource. Heron says while she isn't completely against the idea of miscanthus being burned as ethanol, regulating those emissions is key.
What does burning anything do to our community? And then how our regulatory agency set up on a maximum level mitigates those negative impacts to people and the environment.
Back in central West Virginia, Jeff Skousen is no stranger to the fact that burning biomass releases carbon. But for Skousen, he ultimately wants to find a use for land that coal mining has left behind.
And I just would like to see many more of these lands used in profitable ways, because I think the resources here, land is a permanent resource, and it's always here.
Skousen hopes this hardy grass can be that solution. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. A nonprofit is teaching underserved kids to stand up paddleboard and to think more about the rivers where they're learning.
All this bad stuff goes into it, then this affects the animals' ecosystem and stuff they eat.
Balancing conservation with fun. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front.
This was awesome!
Stay tuned.
It's awesome! Wreck and roll!
Do you like zombie fiction or movies, or are they a nightmare for you? Well, this next story isn't horror, it's nature. A fungus is infecting cicadas in our region, effectively turning them into zombie insects. West Virginia University researchers have been studying this phenomenon, which is impacting annual cicadas and the periodical ones that only emerge in multi-year cycles. WVU forest pathologist Matt Kasson spoke with Kylie Kaczynski of 90.5 WESA's program, The Confluence.
The headlines are sensational. Zombie bugs are among us. But this fungus you're studying, Massospora cicadina, is sort of inhibiting these bugs from controlling their own bodies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So how is this fungus affecting cicadas?
Well, the fungus has a long co-evolved relationship with the cicadas. It's been infecting cicadas for as long as cicadas have been around. And it kind of modifies behaviors in two ways. The first is that it seems to enhance the typical behaviors of cicadas. We see infected cicadas flying around a lot, engaging in mating behaviors a lot. This is typical of healthy individuals. And then there's this kind of hypersexualization where infected individuals, males, for example, in addition to attempting to mate with females, will also pretend to be females to engage with males to further spread the fungus. And this is all behavioral modification on the part of the fungus to ensure that it's spread to as many individuals as possible.
So where does this fungus live and how does it attach itself to the cicadas?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the fungus, for a good part of its life cycle, hangs out underground in the form of these really thick-walled spores. They start to interact with the cicadas when they come up in the 17th year as they get ready to emerge and molt into adults. They produce these kind of vertical emergence chambers subsurface, right below bricks and right below leaves. It's there where they first encounter the spores, and we believe that the spores are actually cueing in to the hormones of the cicadas. That's how they know to germinate. That's how they know that they've found the right host.
Spreading on one host, it sort of replaces that part of the bug, and that part of the bug becomes sort of like a sculpture of the bug, but it's the fungus?
That's right. Yeah, it looks a lot like the abdomen. It's shaped like the abdomen, but it's all fungal tissue. And, you know, the cicadas that are infected, it's like they don't even notice that the whole backside of their body has been replaced by fungal tissue. And that's why they continue to engage in these activities. And we kind of hypothesized that these compounds we found in these fungi could explain why they continue to do this, despite the fact that, you know, a third to half their body has completely fallen off and been replaced by this fungus.
So, Matt, WVU researchers, including yourself, have been learning about the chemical makeup of Massospora. How does it work?
What we found is that there were about 1,000 to 1,500 unique compounds that were present only in the fungal plugs. And of those compounds, a few of them stood out because there are known alkaloids, and alkaloids are these interesting metabolites that have known impacts on vertebrates, including psilocybin and cathinone, which were two of the ones that we kind of highlighted in our study. So, you know, I want to emphasize the fact that although we focused on these two psychedelic compounds, there were over 1,000 compounds.
I just want to clarify, those two compounds are the chemicals in hallucinogenic mushrooms, correct?
Well, one of them is. Psilocybin is the active compound in hallucinogenic mushrooms. The other compound, cathinone, is actually an amphetamine that's found native in cat plant, which is found in the Horn of Africa and utilized in the Arabian Peninsula.
So we know how those affect humans. Do we know anything about how they're affecting the cicadas, those two particular chemicals?
This is kind of the complicated part of the project, is that both these compounds are DEA regulated. Fortunately for us, there was a lot of studies done on the impacts of these compounds on invertebrates, including insects, back in the 60s and 70s. We know, for example, that when you give ants amphetamines, they get more aggressive. We know that if you give spiders psilocybin or LSD, they produce really unusual webs. They call them drug webs. So there's a number of studies that kind of we can like lean on and start to understand how these compounds may impact invertebrates.
So the fungus takes over part of their body. How are these cicadas still living? How are they still moving around and flying?
That's really the question we asked when we first started this study. You know, we would find individuals where a third to half their body was missing, and yet they were moving around as if nothing had happened, as if nothing was wrong. And it was that kind of prolonged wakefulness that really drove our research question. We know, for example, that during war, combat soldiers were given amphetamines. And we know that that gave them, you know, kind of increased stamina and things like that. And we're seeing that probably to be true in the cicada system as well. I know, for example, if my leg were chopped off, I might not have the same kind of stamina that if I was completely intact. So you think about this from the cicada standpoint. They're having their abdomens cut open, their genitalia basically cut off, yet they're continuing on with a lot of energy. And, you know, the amphetamine that we're finding present in these fungal plugs could explain a lot of that.
Are there any implications for humans that might come in contact with this fungus? Is there something humans should be doing to prevent it from spreading?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the question we get a lot is, if I eat one of these cicadas, will I trip or, you know, will it cause euphoria or things like that? And, you know, the dose is pretty low. It would take a lot of cicadas to really impact a human. But I think, you know, with regard to, like, the impact on humans is really more of a pharmaceutical impact. You know, if we find novel biosynthetic routes for these compounds, might make it easier to synthesize some of these compounds in the lab, and we might find novel intermediate compounds that could have some utility in medicine or in the pharmaceutical industry. So the finding that these compounds are present really raises the question, what else is out there? And how could we utilize them for human medicine, or how could we utilize them, you know, as a pharmaceutical for different illnesses?
That was Matt Kasson, a forest pathologist and professor at West Virginia University, speaking with Kylie Kaczynski of 90.5 WESA. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. We inspire conservation in unconventional ways. That's the tagline for First Waves, a program that combines stand-up paddleboarding, river surfing, and filmmaking to create a new generation of conservationists. The nonprofit targets underserved youth across western Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis went to Johnstown last summer to check out a First Waves program, but the day didn't go exactly as planned.
When Ian Smith started his paddleboard company, Surfs Up Adventures, in 2011, he didn't intend to take kids out on the water. He was picturing 20-somethings out for a good time. But then the state hired him to come up with a paddleboard program for at-risk teens.
I was really terrified because my first time, you know, working with teenagers.
Fast forward 7 years, and Smith's nonprofit, First Waves, has served hundreds of kids. Today, he's at a park along the Stony Creek River in Johnstown, getting things ready for a group of kids from a foster home nearby. The paddleboards are unloaded, wetsuits and water shoes sit in rows on picnic tables, and volunteers listen as Smith goes over the plan for the day.
So we'll start them in this eddy right here where the flow is obstructed by that wave, and we'll work on getting the kids comfortable standing up in that area. Sound good? All right, and they're arriving, so I'm going to go handle that. What's up, guys? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the kids file in, and some are pretty nervous.
My name is Evan, and I am 12 years old.
Have you ever done this before?
No.
How are you feeling about it?
Kind of nervous, because I'm afraid I might fall off.
Others, like 17-year-old Cameron, have done this before and are excited to be back.
I'm hoping to have a lot of fun. Get back on a paddleboard. It's been about a year and a half.
Just welcome to Greenhouse Park. We did have a crazy rainstorm, so don't worry about these crazy-looking water up here. We're going to go down below where it's a little bit more calm. So we got some awesome DSLR cameras, we got microphones, so we're going to be teaching you guys to tell the story of the day.
The story of the day was supposed to go like this. The kids split up into two groups, half get into wetsuits and practice balancing before heading into the river. The other half gets a lesson on documentary filmmaking and record their friends' river adventures with GoPro cameras and boom mics. Then they switch. But on this day, the river has a different plan.
I don't think I'm going in there. It's not worth the risk, right? I don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is.
Right in front of our eyes, the river has turned an alarming shade of black. Kirsten Wingler is a volunteer. She's supposed to teach paddling skills today.
I've been on this river for 28 years. I've never seen it that color.
Never seen it. I've done a lot of river running in some dirty water. I've never seen this color, so I'm confused. I don't know what this means.
One of the adults standing nearby thinks he has a pretty good idea what it means. Chad Gonkovich runs the Whitewater Tubing Company in town.
So this is with the heavy rain that we had. We're assuming that one of our bony piles or coal fields had a landslide into one of the local creeks. All that coal dust just makes the water, you know, look black. And if you look closely to it, you'll see big hunks of coal coming in.
Just upstream, there's a coal mine and a rail yard with piles of coal along the tracks. What exactly happened is still being investigated by the state. But Ian Smith quickly shifts gears.
If I can leave you with anything today, it's to remember this experience and hopefully inspire you to want to make a change in this. So do a great job documenting this, and today you're actually going to use it with purpose.
The kids begin taking pictures and using the video cameras to document what's happened to the river. But 14-year-old Nakia can't hide her disappointment.
It was sad. It helped me understand the rivers a little bit more. All this bad stuff goes into it, then this affects the animals' ecosystem and the trees and stuff they eat.
17-year-old Raquel is just as bummed.
We're kind of hoping that it does clear out. We didn't really get to go surfing today because the water is this color, so.
You can come back next week?
Hopefully, yeah. Good. I'm hoping.
Yay. Me too.
The next week, the kids do come back, and this time, the river cooperates.
This was awesome!
It's 15-year-old Haley's first time on a paddleboard.
I did a wave my first time, too. It's awesome. Wreck and roll.
That's crazy. These kids are nuts.
And Evan, the kid who was nervous about falling off.
That was amazing. I'm definitely going to do it again.
Now he's a pro.
I fell off of the board, but I swam my way back to shore.
And the conservation part of it, they're getting the hang of that, too.
Have you seen any trash on the river today?
Piece of metal. It's from a pipe. Guess I should get them out of the water.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
Nice eddy catch, man! All right, Donna, now your turn. You can walk your way out. Yep, take it nice and slow.
But can you get with
you? You did great, yeah.
And this year, First Waves launched its first watershed sampling program in partnership with the Conemaugh Valley Conservancy. The organization says it's a way to begin tracking measurable impacts that First Waves and other conservation programs are having on the health of Pennsylvania's rivers and streams. That story is part of our ongoing wildlife and conservation series. For more, check out AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Swetland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth.